Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
That's where Apple has to do some quite swift catching up in terms of, can it be more relevant to me than what I have been using? Can it make good recommendations? Can it understand me?
More from Stuart Dredge later as we discuss the UK's first week of Apple Music. Welcome to Text Message. I'm Nate Langson.
And I'm Ian Morris.
And we start with this week's picks from the UK Tech Tree. And we're going to start by talking about a topic dear, near and dear to Ian's heart, millennials. Because according to an Ofcom report released a few days ago, millennials are snubbing the living room for on-demand TV. And this is according to the write-up we're using by Sophie Curtis on The Telegraph, who writes that young people are deserting the living room television in droves, preferring instead to stream video on their tablets and smartphones. And apparently, people between the ages of 16 and 24 only watch half of the TV live. The rest is all on catch-up. Now, this, on the one hand, to me, doesn't sound enormously surprising. You know, I don't watch any live TV at all. I don't even have the box in the house that is enabling of that service, although I do pay my license fee, I hasten to add. So I'm lower down here, so it doesn't surprise me that people a lot younger than myself are using it half. If anything, I'm more surprised that it's as much as half. What do you think, Ian?
I just hate the word millennials. I just don't even really, every time I hear it, I'm like, what does that even mean? Oh, right, it means people, you know, born around the millennium or whatever, or people entering adulthood now kind of thing.
But you know what? That's what's weird about this, is that it isn't even that. It's broader still.
Well, that's what, like, I was going to say as well. Is it even more than that?
It's as far back as the early 80s, according to some people.
But that's me. I mean, I'm old, but I know I'm late 70s. So what? Early 80s? I'm not okay, millennial.
Let's use that as an unplanned benchmark.
Okay.
How much of your live TV watching do you do live?
Absolutely none.
None at all.
I can't be held to someone else's schedule, Nate. You know that. We're busy. We've got things to do.
I know, mate. I've been trying to get you to record this podcast for about the last 2 days.
Yes, I do apologise. Well. That was because I was having a nap, because I'm old.
So you're bucking all sorts of trends, both those predictable and not, in that, like me, you're watching no live TV. You're watching it all on catch-up.
I just can't bear it. I can't bear the idea of having to be somewhere at a certain time.
So the question is, this Ofcom report, while on the one hand shouldn't come as a surprise to anybody that that it's half, to us it sounds maybe it is surprisingly high, and that millennials, in our experience, if we are to be classed as millennials, which apparently we are, then just about at least, then we're bucking that trend more than the kids.
Well, I can't really do justice to your usual brilliant analogies, but this is one of those things, isn't it, where it's about convenience. And if, you know, I find having two legs very convenient, and if someone gave me the choice of having a convenient two legs or a slightly inconvenient one leg, I would pick the two legs. So obviously I'm not going to want to inconvenience myself by having to be somewhere to watch TV when I can later go online, click a button and enjoy it. And you know, I watch a lot of iPlayer with the kids as well, because kids really just don't understand why stuff isn't on when they want it to be on. And obviously that's partly my fault, because I've brought my kids up to say, hey, well, let's watch a Peppa Pig then. And I press a button and there's Peppa Pig.
And how old are your kids? Just remind us, your eldest.
Izzy's nearly five and Bob's nearly two. So, you know, these are kids who are going to grow up really not understanding the whole point of live TV apart from events. So obviously,
well, that's the key, you see, because and this is true for advertisers as well. Live TV is considered the holy grail, in a sense, because it's a captive audience. People are talking about it, sharing it, and, you know, getting your hashtag trending, and particularly for the kind of the primetime X Factors and panel-based voting musical shows and things like that's the reason that there are so many of them is that there's a huge commercial interest and people do want to debate them. Mm. And you cannot physically do that in the same way using catch-up. So it could well be that it's going to be basically cooking and antique shows all day in the day. And in the evening, it's going to be nothing but live broadcasts of X Factor and other shows. And periodically, there'll be some Lamming Live, and there will be Autumn Watch.
And maybe EastEnders Live, because they do that every now and then, don't they? But, I mean, in a weirdly perverse way, this is back to the origins of TV, where it wasn't possible to pre-record anything, and everything had to be live. You know, we're going to just see them go crazy and feel like everything has to be live in order to generate that thing. But actually, in many ways, that's not necessarily true. Like, I don't actually, because say I loved X Factor, which I don't, but say I was really interested in that kind of program where I wanted to see a talent show, I still wouldn't probably watch it live, because I don't feel like I need to be involved in that at the time. Unless I was on Twitter, I'd feel perfectly happy watching the performances afterwards and maybe skipping all the, you know, nonsense in between, because they have a lot of this, you know, heartbreaking story about how Doodah's gran is the only thing left and he's singing because of his gran inspiring him. You know, I don't need to hear about that. I want to know whether the singing's any good or not, presumably. Mm. Not that singing's got a great deal to do with talent shows.
I think that it's quite good for journalists industry note. I know at least one freelance entertainment writer who said that he used to get quite a lot of commissions by live tweeting a lot of the live shows, and his comments that would get retweeted, they'd be seen by other outlets, and he'd get commissions that way. So there, I mean, whether you're a consumer, an advertiser, whether you're inside the industry, it does seem that live and particularly events, as you say, are the things pulling together. My worry is that we get to the point where we're broadcasting things live that are a detriment to the content. Because, for example, I remember they were live broadcasting a volcano that was going to at some point erupt. And the only thing that erupted was my blood pressure and my feeling of utter disdain that somebody is in possible, they could put this on the TV and that I would know that it even existed. Knowing about it was annoying enough. Okay, I think that'll do. But let us know what you think. podcast@natelangson.com. If you consider yourself to be a millennial, does this profile of you from Ofcom suggest, does it come across as accurate that you only watch 50% of your live TV? Or if you are older or just at the very outer outskirts of being a millennial, like Ian and myself apparently, and you buck this trend in some way, let us know too. We'll read out some opinions next week. podcast@natelangson.com. Ian, it's time to talk solid state drives. It is a very exciting topic. I'm personally of the opinion that flash memory is one of the few things in tech, with the possible now exception of very low power CPUs, that still maintain a degree of magic. I feel that a number of years in the industry writing about everything that is developing in the world of technology, eventually everything is basically fine. Flash memory, and particularly I speak of micro SD cards, which are now up to the realms of, you know, half a terabyte or something ridiculous, 128 gig, 256 gigabytes on a chip the size of a thumbnail, and not even a big thumbnail, you know.
Yeah, like a really stunted thumbnail, but more even like a sort of pinky fingernail, really.
Exactly. We're talking huge amounts of data. So I always like to note when we have massive doublings of capacity, and it excited Ian as well when I suggested we talk about this. Samsung has announced a laptop SSD, and this is of the size that can fit in a MacBook. It's the same size that would go into, say, a PlayStation. They're the same size discs. This is an SSD that has 2 terabytes. Of storage. It is obviously very expensive. I'm not sure how much the UK price is just yet, because it literally just got announced. But 2 terabytes, that's a doubling of the previous maximum of 1 terabyte. And one of those, I've got one in my MacBook, and although it was half price when I got it, the retail price was £449 suggested.
I've just seen the US price. It's not cheap, is it?
How much is the US price?
Well, from what I can see here, the 2 terabyte 850 Evo is $800, and so, the 850 Pro is $1,000.
So it's probably a little bit more than the 1 terabyte was when it came out, which is actually better than I would have expected. But we're still talking probably $500,000 for 2 terabytes. Now, solid state storage is amazing because it is incredibly fast. Computers boot up in a very, very small amount of time. But the reason that it's particularly interesting to us, and I think this is what we wanted to discuss most, Ian, is that as devices are getting smaller, flash memory is getting much more capacious, if you like. Mm. It means that we get, basically, for most people, very good amounts of storage in most consumer devices. You know, the new MacBook ships with up to 0.5 terabytes already. The MacBook Pros are up to 1 terabyte. But if you do need huge amounts of storage, or say lots of HD editing or even 4K editing on a laptop if you're shooting out in the field, you have to still consider spinning disks. Yeah. And moving into the territory of 2 terabytes of solid state, that's beginning to feel now like the almost the death knell for spinning disks, at least in the consumer marketplace.
I just hate spinning disks. I can't wait for those things to die. The sooner the better.
They're probably going to get a little bit more expensive for a little while at some point because they're going to become so prohibitively expensive to manufacture that, ironically, the flash prices will keep going down. Capacities of the spinning disks will still go up and probably hit the 8 or 10 or 12 terabytes.
Yeah, before... we're already at like 6 or something. Yeah. I mean, in fact, are there not 8 terabyte drives already? Because I know there are some very, very slow drives you can get now that are designed only for archive.
It wouldn't surprise me, but I think the price of those is likely to go up because so many fewer people are buying them that it actually means they have to charge more for them just to keep them in manufacturing. So yeah. I think that we are probably at a turning point now where we're starting to see everybody basically buying SSDs, particularly as it means the 1 terabyte ones are going to cost probably between £100 and £200 within the next 12 months. So there's really no good reason to buy a spinning disk unless you need huge amounts of storage, and that probably means you're a professional, and that probably means you've got a bit more money to spend and they can justify charging that much to keep them in manufacturing. But I think it's a good move. I can't see any downsides to this, and it's only a matter of time before we see the Toshibas and SanDisks of the world releasing their 2 terabytes. They all tend to innovate at the same speed.
Yeah, I mean, they do, and I mean, I don't think there's a lot stopping them from having big drives beyond cost, really. I don't think that there's any sort of technical issue, is there, really? It's purely comes down to what the market will bear in terms of what people are prepared to pay. And I need a lot of storage. I've got a lot, but I'm starting to move it all to NAS units now because I've had 2 3-terabyte drives fail this year. And I think there was something wrong with the whole every manufacturer's 3-terabyte drive were just awful because I've had 2 from 2 different manufacturers die. And
I would say, mate, if I can interject, that the consistent thing in all of this is you. Are you absolutely sure it's not your fault?
I'm pretty sure it's not my fault because I have hard drives in my computer that are really, really old and have been doing solid service for me for many years. I could look now if anyone was interested, but they're not because why would they be? But I have a 500 gigabyte drive, so that sort of ages it a bit, doesn't it? I mean, that's years old. Mm. And it's fine. But both the 3 terabyte drives I've had have both failed. So I don't know, yeah. The thing is, for desktop computers, unless you might as well put everything in a NAS. It's safer. You can have RAID. For storing your apps and stuff for games, you're better off having an SSD anyway. It's much quicker. There are some really nice. Have you seen these? Because obviously the SATA standard is quite slow, so you now get PCI Express SSDs that are phenomenally quick. I mean,
that's what's in my new MacBook Pro.
Yeah, I mean that stuff is insane. Like the kind of write speeds and read speeds you can get from that is another level entirely. I mean, it completely takes away all of that bottleneck around storage, and just means that you can really sort of get a lot more out of your computer. If I had a choice and if I could afford it, I'd be all SSDs. But, you know, these things take time.
They do indeed. Well, you can take a look at these. I think they're on sale now, or certainly before too long. I can't see a mention of a UK availability, but these things tend to basically be available worldwide pretty quickly after they launch. So let us know if you pick one up and what you think of it.
And we'll be happy to take, you know, 5 or 6 each for review, won't we, Nate?
Absolutely. I categorically need 8 to comprehensively review.
Absolutely.
But let us know any of your thoughts on SSDs if you use them. And if you're still somebody who buys spinning discs, that's going to be very interesting to find out why and what need is there for you. podcast@natelangson.com. Well, let's talk a brief moment about feedback. We've had a few emails that we had about cinema, so thank you to everyone that's still ranting about 3D cinema. But I wanted to point out just one quick note that came in from Dennis in Ireland, who said that he's loving the show and that we've actually got 4 reviews on the iTunes Ireland site as of today, and they're all 5 stars, including his. Thank you very much. And he started listening to the show after he heard me on Tech Stuff, the podcast that I did with Jonathan Strickland. He said he listened to that one for quite a while. So that's great to know, and thank you very much, because we are, I'm not even sure the current total we're up to on the iTunes store, but I mean, the last time I looked at it, I think it was around the 65 mark and 5-star reviews, and we hit number 80 in the charts. Out of all podcasts in the world, we hit number 80 at one point.
It's just amazing, isn't it?
Which was quite good. But do let us know if you leave a message on the non-UK stores. Unfortunately, when I check for reviews, 66, according to the page I just pulled up, 66. It's 5 stars, so thank you very much. We checked the UK one, but there's so many stores around the world that people do leave reviews on other ones, it seems, as Dennis has pointed out. But we don't necessarily get to see them because we don't get notified. So if you have left one, or if you notice in your local store that we have some reviews, please let us know, or maybe take a screen grab or something like that and send them to podcast@natelangson.com. Very appreciative, and of course, to everyone who leaves feedback there and tells their friends and colleagues.
Today we're announcing Apple Music, the next chapter in music, and I know you are going to love it.
1 week ago today, Apple released Apple Music to the UK and the world. Its answer to Spotify, the opening of the iTunes Store to subscription-paying listeners, its new beginnings as a global music radio provider. Back at its unveiling in June, the company made some typically lofty claims about the importance of Apple Music. Things like,
Apple Music is all of the ways you love music, all in one place.
And other things like,
it will change the way that you experience music forever.
And just when we thought, this is iTunes Radio all over again, US only release, blah, blah, blah.
And we're launching in over 100 countries later this month with iOS 8.4 for your iPhone, iPod Touch and iPad, as well as a new version of iTunes for the Mac, a new version of iTunes for Windows, and Android is coming this fall.
Well, Apple Music has been available for a week now. I've been using it, Ian has been using it, and Stuart Dredge, a media expert and journalist for The Guardian and Music Ally, has been using it. We've learned a lot about how valid Apple's faith is in its service as the be-all and end-all of music services. We've experienced things we like a lot and some things we don't. It's too early to draw any fair conclusions yet about the product because so much of what Apple intends it to be relies on customers using it and thus giving Apple the information about their listening habits that it needs to offer a personalized experience. It also needs artists to fulfill their end of the so-called bargain, filling up the social networking side of the platform with yet more content aimed at bringing fan and musician ever closer together. It's at this point it's worth casting a thought back to iTunes Ping, the short-lived social network within iTunes that had what seems like one of the briefest lifespans of any digital product in Apple's recent history, at just 2 years to the month. But even with Ping in mind, it's equally important for cynics and supporters to remember the power Apple wields in the digital music world. iTunes is the biggest music retailer on the planet, bigger than Amazon, bigger than any sort of HMV-like high street retailer, bigger than the lot. And it has sold over 1 billion iOS devices since 2007. That's iPhones, iPads, and iPod Touches. And every single one of them that Apple still supports has something in common. They have iTunes pre-installed, and they have a 3-month free trial of Apple Music waiting for them. There's no doubt that whatever Apple does with Apple Music, it's going to have a big impact. I mentioned music and technology journalist Stuart Dredge just now, and I caught up with him this week. He follows the industry every hour of every day, and he's been using Apple Music while doing so. I started by asking him how he thinks the launch was received by the UK in its important first few days of life.
I think the industry has been very excited about this for a while. I think because they want competition for Spotify. They want two or three kind of big streaming services competing to innovate with new features, competing in marketing themselves. They don't want one player dominating like iTunes did in the download space. So people are very excited about the kind of the fact that it's here finally and existing. I think people are picking over the details. Like people are saying, oh, well, the design could be improved. It's not quite as accessible as Spotify. People are looking at the kind of the approach to curation and figuring out how that works. I think everyone is just trying to get to grips with how Apple are running it, where the room for improvement is. And I think most sensible people are trying to avoiding making those kind of hot take things of saying it's a success and Spotify is doomed or vice versa. I think everyone's it's an encouraging start. It's the kind of feeling I'm getting.
And what about Beats One, Apple's answer to BBC Radio One in some respects? Does it stand up as well in the UK as in the US?
Well, it's been really interesting, especially seeing people in the US going loopy about a radio station that plays records it likes and isn't kind of... Cause I think you sort of understand that I think we're quite spoiled here, and we have Radio 1 and we have Six Music and all these stations. We're kind of used to stations having specialist shows and kind of having playlists that aren't completely sort of focus group into oblivion. So outside the UK, people have been like, this is amazing. And over here, we're sort of saying, well, it's kind of like saying low on Radio 1. We're used to this. But yeah, I mean, I think it has been... It's been really interesting, that idea of humans picking songs and recommending. I mean, there's been lots of talk about algorithms versus humans and how you get your recent recommendations. And the fact that Beats One has been exciting people kind of does show that there is that role for humans in this process, and humans talking to you and saying, this is really amazing, and playing a song. It's still a valuable thing, I think. So yeah, I think in terms of replacing Radio One, I mean, you can sort of tell the BBC are running around a bit in a kind of, this is a real big challenge for us. And I've been quite interested to notice that the focus hasn't really been on, is Apple Music a Spotify killer? It's more in, is it a radio killer over here in the US?
For the UK, there are stark similarities between Beats One and BBC Radio One. Should Radio One be concerned?
Apple's thing is very much live radio, tune in. I mean, they haven't even got kind of iPlayer-style archiving. So if you don't catch Dr. Dre's show, I think it's about 11 p.m. UK time, you've got to listen to it at 11 a.m. the next day. And it's those two kind of points. You can't go and download the show and listen to it like you would with, I don't know, Zane Lowe's old Radio 1 show. So that's one difference. I mean, the other thing as well is Radio 1, you can see they're kind of expanding other ways. So Radio 1 have got this YouTube channel. It's got like, I think, a million subscribers now. And they're very much saying, actually, their definition of radio is expanding to video and YouTube and online video. So I think there's room for both. I think it's quite good if Beats 1 is pushing people like Radio 1 to carry on innovating, carry on, find different ways to reach the people who listen to it. I think it's quite healthy in a similar way to where I think the competition with Spotify, that competition to kind of bring out new features and make it easier to use will be healthy overall. I think it's the same for radio. I don't think it's like killing anything. I think it will give it a good shot in the arm, hopefully.
It's only a matter of time before shows or interviews from Beats 1 or Beats 2, 5, 10, 50 are archived for streaming or even purchasing. Apple has a history of hosting live sessions for artists around the world, and in September each year, it hosts the iTunes Music Festival at London's Roundhouse in Camden, a free-to-attend month of daily concerts with headlines ranging from Lady Gaga to Paul Simon to Muse, all of which were either live-streamed for free on Apple TV or iTunes, or made available for paid download as an exclusive EP for fans afterwards. Could this be the next step for Beats One?
Yeah, definitely. And even you can see them putting the interviews on YouTube. Well, that's not what you paid for, but they're putting the Zane Lowe's interview with Eminem is on YouTube, I think. And so I think it's going to be a good competition. I think the other thing is, I think Beats One is only the start. I think if this goes well, you will see Beats Two, Beats Three. Because the one interesting thing is this idea of a global station aimed at everyone. And the focus seems to be new music and independent music. So it's very much like Zane Lowe's show was on Radio One. But Apple has this huge audience of people who probably will tune in here on the Jewels and go, this is a little bit too cutting edge for me. I quite like some older stuff. So there is scope for them to take on Radio 2, take on Six Music, take on dance channels. So I think we'll see this is kind of a trail run for, can Apple run a network of radio stations with people? So I'm fascinated by it, seeing how that spins out.
Let's step inside the industry a bit. Spotify, Deezer, Napster, Tidal, Google Play. They're all sitting here around me looking bit nervous. Do we have any indication yet that users are leaving one for the other, or is it basically just too early to tell?
I think it's super early to judge. I know there were a lot of people giving the trial a go. So, I mean, there's a lot of people saying, sorry, Spotify, I'm giving Apple Music a try because it's free. So a lot of people are going to, they've got 3 months. If they've got an iPhone or an iPad, they can try it. Obviously, people who are on Android haven't got Apple Music yet, so they're not trying it. So they haven't fled away from Spotify. But yeah, I think you can see a lot of sampling. You can see people trying it and seeing what they think. And then either, I mean, I've seen tweets, and you can't judge it from tweets. You know, I've seen three tweets, therefore it's conclusive. But I've seen people saying, so long, Spotify, this is great. And I've seen people saying, no, I'm back to Spotify, I couldn't hack this. So it really is going to be, in 3 months' time, we'll start seeing if Spotify has cancellations or if people start flooding back to it. There'll be a lot. I think pretty much anyone who is on Spotify but has an iPhone will be giving this a try because they've already shown they're interested in streaming music and interested in paying for it. So, there'll be a lot of sampling, I think, rather than anyone deciding for sure yet.
With a billion iOS devices sold and counting, is there a risk that Apple is so big, controls so much of the experience a music customer has with its services and devices, that Spotify's place in the App Store itself could be threatened?
I think there's definitely an issue to watch there, and I'm fascinated as a journalist in watching this. So I think Apple has some advantages that are clear from its platform. So it can put the music app on everyone's iPhone, it can give them all a free trial, it can do massive promotion, it can you know, run ads on TV, which are for Apple products still, but promoting the music service. So those are some advantages. The other thing it has is it has that thing of if you pay for a subscription for Spotify, Apple takes 30% of the cut. So for that reason, people like Spotify will charge sort of $12.99 if you subscribe through iOS, because that lets Apple take its 30% while Spotify still gets a tenner. So in a way, because Apple has the App Store and it has that cut of revenues, rivals often have to up their price, whereas Apple can leave it at 10 quid and it still gets all the money because it's a platform owner. Anything more than that, I think Apple is too smart to go down that route, because there's already been talk about, is there anti-competition issues here? I think Spotify has already shown it's willing to go and complain to the regulators if it sees bad being done. So in terms of disincentivizing people directly not to have Spotify or hampering its app being approved, I'd be really surprised if that happens, because that would be an instant complaint to the EC and to the FTC in the US.
To close, Stuart comments that the winner between Spotify and Apple is not going to be its catalog or the catalog of any of these services, but more about which of them knows the customer best and offers the most personalized experience at the end of any free trial.
A long free trial was a good idea, because people have shown before that if you give someone a week's free trial of a streaming service, it's not really enough time for them to know whether they like it or not. It's done a good job on the, I mean, the playlists look really good, the kind of the curated playlists. So, I mean, I keep getting recommended Snow Patrol deep cuts, which I'm not entirely convinced by, because I'm not a big fan of them. But they have got a sort of quite a deep list of stuff that's kind of theme playlists or bands or so on. So we're doing a lot of work, I think, on the back end. One thing I'm seeing as not necessarily something doing wrong, but something they have to catch up with, is that Spotify in particular, if you've been on there for 3 years, it has a lot of data about your listening habits, and it's got quite a smart division of its company focused on using that information to make better recommendations, to kind of connect you with playlist creators you'd like. A lot of the kind of the human sort of algorithm stuff. So Apple's going to have to catch up. I mean, thinking of my example, I mean, iTunes doesn't know very much about my music habits, because I haven't really bought much from it in the last few years, because I was using Spotify. So it knows I bought the Beyonce album, it knows I bought the Taylor Swift album, and it knows I bought a couple of other things that weren't on Spotify, whereas Spotify knows everything I've listened to for 5 years. So that's where Apple has to do some quite swift catching up in terms of, can it be more relevant to me than what I have been using? Can it make good recommendations? Can it understand me?
Well, Ian is still here, of course, and I wanted to get his views on Apple Music. And one of the things I wanted to talk to you about first, Ian, was streaming, and particularly the quality of streaming. You and I, over the years, have had many conversations about music quality and the benefits or lack thereof of lossless and high res and things like that. And one of the things that I've noticed in using Apple Music so far is that if you're connected to Wi-Fi, or if you download a song to your library to play back, you get basically the same quality version that's in the iTunes store, which is 256 kilobits per second in AAC, which for the sake of argument is basically the same as Spotify's top end setting and Amazon's standard MP3 setting. Where this,
I think Google does about 256 MP3s as well, so it's probably a bit better than that.
It is. Some of them are complicated because they're variable bitrate, whereas Apple's is constant bitrate. So, but I think broadly speaking, they're all roughly around the same point, the high end of what is possible for each format. What I've noticed about Apple Music, though, is if you stream a song over 3G, it is streaming at a noticeably lower bitrate. Now, that's noticeable to me, and I am, you know, listening out for this kind of stuff, to be fair. And it's not that it sounds bad, but it is very clearly lower res. It's got all the telltale signs of a not badly compressed audio file, but one that has been compressed at the level to ensure the minimum file size while maintaining the feeling of CD quality, which is that kind of crystalline sort of high end. But you can hear cymbals sort of wobbling because they haven't got enough data to save the shimmer of a cymbal, for one thing. And
weirdly, that was what I noticed with the Beats One launch, actually. At the start of that, it was I could hear all that shimmering and it was awful. And then suddenly the variable bitrate seemed to, because they have various streams, don't they? I think that they dynamically shift you around. And then it suddenly got better for the Beats audio.
This is the thing. They haven't come out and explicitly said so. I think Eddie Q tweeted that there is a difference for streaming or for mobile, but we don't know how extensive the difference is, whether it's adaptive bitrate, which is what, for most people, you notice if you press play at iPlayer and you think the picture's a bit blurry to begin with, but then it sort of sharpens up a few seconds later. Mm. That's called adaptive bitrate, and it means that if you don't have enough bandwidth on your internet connection, it will just choose a lower quality beginning of the file or middle of the file, and as your buffer increases, it can download higher quality. The difference is that on Spotify you can change this. So there is a normal setting, there is a higher setting, and then there's a what they call extreme, which is 320, which is for all intents and purposes the same as all the download stores. And Apple does not have one. My guess is that it is to preserve data usage on mobile, not for their benefit probably, but for users not being stuck with large data bills. But I'm very perturbed that this is not an option yet to change. And I hope an option to change this comes with iOS 9, because although I'm not going to say that if I'm just streaming a song, I'm super concerned about quality, because it'll mean I'm outdoors and I'm on headphones, I'm moving, I'm not at home connected to my hi-fi, my big speakers, where you'll really notice that. But it bugs me that I'm going to notice this every time. And I would just love, as a paid user, or will be in 3 months' time, be a paid user, I would just love to be able to change that quality to at least be the same as the iTunes store if I download them.
Do you not think, though, that it might be one of the very traditional Apple things whereby they're just trying to make it nice and easy for everyone, and that's why they haven't put that choice in, rather than get people who are possibly going to be the least technically literate streamers of anyone and just not give them the choice so that it doesn't confuse them?
Yes, but
I don't personally agree with that as a standpoint, because I think that you put it in a settings menu and no one ever needs to see it until they decide they want to change it.
Aha, and that's the key point, because that's what they do for ripping CDs, is that there is a there is a default for converting to if you rip a CD into lossless and you want to move it onto your phone. Previously there was only one setting, which was to compress it down to the same as the iTunes store, which at the time was 128 kilobits AAC. They eventually changed that to give you the option of choosing a higher bitrate for those on the fly conversions. But you've got no control over whether it's AAC or MP3. You can't pick the bitrate other than the two or three Apple offers you. And I think it would be good, at least to remain competitive with Spotify, for Apple to integrate a quality control, particularly when it comes to 3G, because it does, at the moment at least, offer Spotify competitive advantage, saying if you stream over mobile, you can choose high quality, you know, and high quality was Tidal's big pitch. Might not be a big seller, but for nerds and people like me, who is both a nerd and myself, this is quite an important issue.
Yeah, definitely. And also, Apple's gone to a lot of effort recently to improve the DAC quality in the iPhone so that it's actually very good now.
Yeah.
So why not take advantage of it?
Well, the last thing I wanted to ask you about with Apple Music, Ian, is how you're finding recommendations. Because on my side of the fence, I'm going to be most interested in hearing sort of unusual heavy metal that I don't already know. And I put a lot of time and effort into staying ahead of the curve and listening to new bands. And so the key for me is for iTunes to surface from its catalog unusual or old or out of the way metal bands that I don't already know. Currently, despite using iTunes for 10 years, the music it's suggesting to me on its For You channel, the kind of radio and playlists part of Apple Music, it's stuff I either already own, despise, or I would consider largely irrelevant. For example, it knows, iTunes knows, that I have all of Funeral for Friends' albums. They're not particularly metal, but let's just go with that. For some reason, they're on top of my head. All their albums, and they know that I've played the first two albums to completion 20 or 30 times. And yet, one of the top playlists that I saw this morning coming into work was Intro to Funeral for a Friend. Now, there's no need for it to be there. I like it. And yeah, maybe I'll go and listen to a bit of Funeral for a Friend later today. But I'd much rather it say, here's this unusual band from France who has the same drummer and bassist from this band, which we see you like, that sounds like this other band we see you like. Maybe you'd like this one. It doesn't need to be manually curated, but it should recommend those. And Spotify tends to be better at that so far. And I wanted to hear your thoughts and how your experience has been, because you listen to quite a lot of odd electronic music and trance and EDM and Katy Perry. So.
But you know what's interesting as well? I mean, you basically use iTunes all the time, don't you? And I don't at all. And I don't, in fact, even now, I don't have my library in iTunes. So it doesn't really have any play counts for me. And what it's done is pretty much picked the sort of thing that I would probably listen to for the most part. Like, not the stuff that I like, but I tend to listen to a lot of kind of quite middle-of-the-road pop kind of stuff when I'm working or whatever. And it seems to have done not a bad job of picking that out, with a smattering of kind of the sort of, you know, commercial dance stuff that I tend to end up listening to a bit as well, like, you know, Tiesto and things like that.
Which I guess...
Hardwell.
I guess that's Apple's whole angle. I mean, they're going for the mainstream with this launch, and they're certainly going for the mainstream with Beats and with Beats One. So maybe,
but funnily enough, a lot of what I loved was stuff that I was listening to on Beats One, which is stuff I've never heard before. So I think, because what they did with, you know, what I've quite liked about Beats One, particularly on the launch night, was that they, not Zane Lowe, I didn't think he was particularly good, but with a lot of the other DJs, they actually played some really good, interesting stuff that I wanted to hear more of. So I did do a lot of loving that. But that hasn't really shown up, I don't think, in the For You thing. But I don't know why. I haven't used it enough, I don't think. I think, ask me again at the end of the 3-month trial, and I might have a better answer for you.
Well, we certainly will. This is the last episode that we're probably going to talk about Apple Music at any length. But in 3 months, we will do another one and review the previous 3 months and see how it's affected our listening habits and the industry.
Will we be paying or not is the key question, isn't it?
Well, I think I probably will, but only because I don't... Although I do have Spotify Premium, but I actually use that more just for sampling new stuff, and then I'll end up either buying individual songs off iTunes if I only like one or two of them, or I buy the CD if I like the most of the album or the band. But yeah, we'll come back to it and review that. But do you listen to, or did you listen to, or still listen to Radio 1, BBC Radio 1?
No, not really.
So it's
because weirdly, I don't find Radio 1 particularly good for discovering music. Like, I don't think it moves around quickly enough. The thing about Beats 1 that was struck me launch night, and I've forgotten the girl's name who does it from London. Do you remember her name?
I didn't know it in the first place.
She was very, very good, actually. And I think what she did was a really nice mix of music that I thought, you know, not all of it appealed to me, and not all of it I would have assumed would have appealed to me, but actually there were a few tracks in there that I really enjoyed, and I'd like to listen to stuff around that. So I think that's probably the most interesting part of it. They have taken it away from that traditional radio model of this is just the top 40 essentially, and maybe a little bit outside of Radio 1's not bad, but it is a variation on a very tried and tested method, which is chart music. And I would like to discover new stuff, because I'm always thinking, oh, I'm bored of all this music, I want to hear something new, and no one is able to give me that well.
Well, that's going to do it for this week's text message. Thank you so much for listening. And thank you, of course, to Stuart Dredge for talking to me about Apple Music. And of course, for anybody wanting to do something as a thank you for the show every week, the best thing you can do that would mean the most to me is to go to iTunes and leave a review, letting other people know that you enjoyed the show. Or, of course, tell a colleague, tell a friend about the podcast. And if they're not listening to any podcasts already, maybe offer to help them. Download an app for them. Give them some advice about how apps work when it comes to podcasting on mobile devices. And maybe subscribe them to Text Message First if you think they're into tech or any other podcast. Basically, the more people listening to podcasts, the more chances there are that they'll tell someone else to start listening to them too.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.